This summer, while Northern Soundings took a break, we reintroduced a new generation to a wonderful series KUAC broadcast almost 30 years ago. Conversations featured Susan McGinnis talking with some historically significant and thoughtful people about Alaska and the American West. Susan has selected some former discussions for this summer series, and this concluding show, she talks with historian Patricia Limerick. Here's Susan.
Here's a concluding thought from historian Patricia Limerick's major work, The Legacy of Conquest. She writes, "Celebrating one's past, one's traditions, one's heritage, is a bit like hosting a party. One wants to control the guest list tightly." I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. We'll spend the next hour with historian Patricia Limerick looking at the subject of the American West and the history that's been created around it. Patty, when you admonished potential celebrants to control the guest list of their history, are you saying that history is a little more complex, a little messier than a party?
Oh, absolutely. That the open invitation of we'll celebrate the frontier past. You issue that invitation and you've got a lot of people showing up that you probably did not plan on if you thought it was just going to be a festive venture in the state of Colorado. If you want to celebrate the frontier past, well, that means you're going to reckon with Sand Creek Massacre of 1864, and really one of the most unpleasant encounters of human beings in North America. Well, that's what you're going to have to face up to, is an occasion when a lot of white folks took out their anger on the bodies of Indian women and children. So now that seems to me in some ways better to have a richer, more complicated history to think about and ponder and learn from. But it seems as if most of the people planning for their Frontier Day celebrations, their old times, it's just going to be fun. It's just going to be a happy face version of the past. And that's just not going to work.
All right. Does that make you a different kind of historian?
Well, actually, I think that there are plenty of other historians like me who see the past in complicated terms, but most of those write in ways that no normal human being could ever read. So I think actually I'm a fairly representative academic historian in seeing the complexity and the costs and the dilemmas that come with progress and all that. But the unfortunate thing is that most academic historians write a kind of language that says keep out, that has big barbed wire fences around it.
And so one of the differences you bring to the field is wanting to write in a way that's readable,
that makes
the history come alive?
Absolutely, because I think it's everybody's first notion that the people of the past have been dead so long that they're somehow just a different kind of group from us. There's a story I always tell at the beginning of my American History Survey classes where you have a lot of non-majors who are not in there with the happiest view of what history is going to be. So I always tell the story about this little kid who was taken to see the Supreme Court sitting in session, and he came and sat there for 2 or 3 hours next to his father, and then a fly came into the chamber and landed on the head of one of the justices, and the justice reached up and flicked the fly away, and the little boy grabbed his father's arm and said, "Look, Dad, one of them's alive! One of them's alive!" Now, I tried to use that story at the beginning to say, contrary to what it seems, these dead people were not always dead, and when alive, they were as fully alive as we, and they were as much on the edge of their particular moment without being able to see the future, living in an unpredictable age, that we just do them a terrible disservice when we pickle them, when we make them either purer or better than they were, or part of an inevitable process of westward expansion or something like that. So it seems very important to restore dead people to their full condition of life as much as you can do that with prose that lives. And also, I just think universities in this country have ended up in the most peculiar state of having academics working very hard and often turning up very interesting material, but then writing it in a form in which only other professors read it, and then whining because the public doesn't understand what they do and doesn't appreciate what they do. Well, so it seemed, and then finally, I think it's just too urgent that these issues of the past and the legacy of the past for our times, those are so urgent and so much upon us that it would be like coming into a room and shouting fire in another language entirely. Or something. I mean, it's just extremely important to get these issues out where the public can relate to them. Plus, I like writing, so there's that too. Some personal self-indulgence in that too, I think.
This is Patty Limerick. Her major book, The Legacy of Conquest, there are other books. We'll talk about them in a while. She is a professor at the University of Colorado, Boulder. Do most of us think as the past, as that judge, as dead, over, gone?
Sure, sure. The poor, I mean, that's one of the most peculiar forms of human thinking. I think I first noticed this, I was reading Simone de Beauvoir when I was in college, and she mentioned how once a man has become old, that's how we think of him forever. Benjamin Franklin, you don't think of the young, really quite wild and, should we say, lustful Benjamin Franklin. You think of the old, stodgy Benjamin Franklin issuing advice to others. So I think that's just a curious form of human memory, that we take the ending and accent the ending and the outcome so much that we miss the beginning and the unpredictability of what it is to be alive. But when we know it in our own lives, I mean, nobody can see the future. I don't think the state of Alaska has been exactly gifted in its prophetic skills for seeing the future in the last 20 years. But we just flatten out the past by assuming that it was foreknown to the people involved as it is known to us by hindsight. And I'm afraid that some of the people who are most devoted to Western history are the ones who have pickled it the most, because they want it to be an inspirational story. They want it to be a story about noble pioneers and a heroic project of taming a wilderness and so on. And once they have put that very simple and unrealistic story up as the framework, then you lose the people themselves. You lose their interest. It seems to me you don't take a thing away from Lewis and Clark. If you look at Lewis and Clark and read their journals and discover how very dependent they were on Indian people, they simply could not have made it without Indian guides and Indian food and Indian horses and so on. But do you reduce the interest of their story to say that one of their major health problems was venereal disease? Does that, it tells us something important about what all these men were doing in their passage across the continent, and it's a fact, and it makes them true human beings. It makes them full, flawed, morally complex human beings.
Right, and this is one of the things that cuts the past off from the present, is this kind of mythic, stereotypic mm-hmm. image of greatness or right. or ruin, one mm-hmm. or the other, mm-hmm. when we are neither great nor totally devastated
that's
ourselves.
The thing that puzzles me more and more is how the people who support the old Western history, the triumphant pioneers, yeah, right, master the tough place, how those people can see that what they offer is optimistic, because it seems to me the terms are just reversed there. They offer a version of the past in which people were grander and bigger and stronger and more than we are. We come off as the sad 20th century moral pygmies in relationship to that, which is not flattering and not encouraging. I mean, I can't think of a better era for heroism in the American West than today, that as we struggle with these terrible social conflicts over resource development and so on, what a fine opportunity for true heroism. And that, so to go around believing that glory lived in the American West in the 19th century and now we live in dreary times, that seems awfully glum to me. And yet the people who offer us that view tell us that they're the ones who are optimistic and I'm the one who's glum, and I think they got their words reversed there.
Another foundation laying question. You write in the beginning, the foreword to Legacy of Conquest, that you got the idea for this book after attending a conference where you listened to representatives of government and representatives of business bemoaning the current problems, mm-hmm. the problems of mm-hmm. the day. Tell me why.
Well, it was 1981. I was at the first conference I ever had attended in my life. Now I'm quite the conference animal, but I did not do that as a younger person. And the first day's session, it was a conference framed in response to the Sagebrush Rebellion, to that late 70s movement of taking back the public lands and distributing them to the states. And the first day, the federal officials and the company officials, energy company officials, all talked about the problems of energy boom towns, problems of insufficient housing, too many single men, too much alcohol, as if this were some new dilemma that came upon the West in the 1970s with the energy boom. And of course, in 1981, the boom was still on. So I just sat there puzzled beyond words of thinking, why don't they know that this has been the pattern of the region for a century and a half? Why are they treating this as if this is a new and fortunate set of social problems? And I thought, well, boy, I certainly wish they would read Western history. And then I thought, well, if they read Western history, they'd be as stupid as they are now, because if they read Western history, they'd read books that told them that the frontier ended in 1890 and the West settled down in a new and more stable and tranquil era. The word that a lot of the traditional Western historians use, the West matured. 1890. Well, don't really see all that many signs. I'm not quite sure what maturity adds up to in a regent's behavior. In any case, I really got a sense of mission out of that, of thinking there has got to be a book in Western history that people in the West today can read that gives them some sense of what has changed and what has not changed in the patterns of the region. So, I really do think those people were my major inspiration. I should have put them in the acknowledgments by name, and the more foolish they were, the more they meant to me as an audience to address. So.
Once again, this is Patty Limerick. Let's take apart some of that kind of history as presented. There are myths, and maybe we can start looking at the myths. One myth is the myth of what you call the myth of innocence, which is to say people came across the West from the East with only good intentions. And, of course, this assumes these are all white people who are settling in, but with only good intentions and only looking for opportunity. True or false?
Or well, both? Certainly reversing that wouldn't help to take the notion that this was the most depraved and wicked horde unleashed on the planet. Certainly doesn't do any justice to the complexity of the issue. But I think what I was going after with the innocence thing was these episodes, time after time, where white people intrude into Indian territory, sometimes in advance of the treaty, and then conflict results, and white farms, white stores, white homesteads are attacked, and the whites have a sort of, well, how dare they? How dare they? We were just innocents. Well, you don't go into a war zone. You don't take somebody else's territory without recognizing that. Well, of course, they do, in fact, do that all the time. They go in with a sense that their motives are so right and so just and so obvious that the fact that they are intruders in another people's land shouldn't count. It shouldn't apply because the whites are using the land right for the proper kinds of economic uses. Indian people were just roaming and wandering, is the common phrase of the 19th century, and the 20th century still goes. So it seemed important to say there is a thing called responsibility in here, and connection and cause. And if you take part in an invasion and there's hell to pay for it, you're part of the cause. You are not the innocent you seem to be. But I think for me the most dramatic contrast in how we thought about our history and how we think about other people's history is with South Africa. When white Americans talk about South Africa, it's perfectly clear that South Africa had an invasion and a conquest, and they are still reckoning with the consequences of that. So South Africa has a invasion and a conquest. The United States has a frontier zone of expanding opportunity and equality and democracy. Now, what's wrong with that picture? That's not the route to national self-knowledge, to see the wickedness as being what Europeans did in another part of the country, and to see ourselves as pure. In many ways, we white Americans ended up with a better situation because Indian people were more subject to disease, to European disease, than African people were. So the fact that there's such a sizable African population still to reckon with, and a visible and important and persistent but small Indian group, that's a biological story. That's not because one group of conquerors were more virtuous or more deserving than another group.
Do we carry that myth of innocence forward in our daily lives today?
Oh, I think it's everywhere. I mean, that's why these are not dead, inconsequential issues. That sense that when Americans seek profit, it's in everybody's interest. It's done because that's how progress occurs. I think that's everywhere, that we are motives are so pure that we engage in what in other nations would be a war of imperialism or a war of invasion and conquest. But in our case, it's just bringing democracy to another part of the planet. I mean, see, I'm not of the school that just sees an unbroken pattern of white behavior from John Winthrop in Massachusetts Bay and the attacks on the Pequot Indians right down to Vietnam and to the Persian Gulf. That's a flat and unimaginative way of reading complex issues. But I think we are permitted by this Western myth to live with a sense of justified virtue that's deluding and dangerous and makes you do unfortunate things. I mean, you can do it. Sometimes people use the Western myth of innocence very craftily. Sometimes it works at a deeper and actually more dangerous level where you're not consciously manipulating the myth. The myth is manipulating you. You're thinking that because your heart is so pure and your intentions are so good that you cannot do injury. But in fact, one of the best ways on earth is to injure people is to do it out of good intentions. I think Thoreau said something about if I know a man is coming to my house to do me good, I will flee as from the hounds of hell. And Western history is full of those stories. You can find many of those stories where missionaries think that they are coming to help Indians, and what they end up doing is introducing European diseases and the wedge of white settlement that does in the people they came to help. Having those lessons on our mind, I think, would be a great kind of national sobering up.
Where does it come from? The myth of innocence had to begin all the way back over on the East Coast, if not further than that.
Well, I think American colonization or colonization on the Atlantic coast could set people up for a notion that by crossing the Atlantic Ocean, you quarantine yourself from the wickedness of Europe. Now, Europe was obviously a place where greedy people picked on each other all the time and warred all the time and innocents died and other people's schemes. Now, that was Europe, but you cross this ocean and it's supposed to be like some kind of great quarantine zone. And, of course, as you cross the ocean, you bring yourself and you bring your own motives and your own consciousness. You bring the infection, if that's what it is, human ambition and greed. That comes as part of the immigration process. That's baggage packed into your head. But I think that's part of it, that faith that somehow you could set yourself off from Europe and this would be a better and happier continent. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the appeal. And then I think one has to give a lot of credit or blame or something to American nature, that the landscape of the American West is so astonishing. And it looks like people who live in a place with the Rockies in view should be better people. That men to match my mountains mode should work. That if you live in a grand landscape, you ought to have a grand society. There's some kind of borrowed hope that if the landscape is as great as it is, that somehow that will become a shaping factor for the society, which not yet. I mean, we won't say it couldn't happen, but it hasn't happened yet. So that escape from Europe and the promise of the American landscape, I think that somewhere in that combination is the source of this.
Some purification happened, at least in the collective imagination.
Right.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. We're talking today with historian Patricia Limerick. Among her books, The Legacy of Conquest was published by W.W. Norton in 1987. It's subtitled The Unbroken Past of the American West. Before that, Desert Passages, Encounters with the American Deserts was published by the University of New Mexico Press in 1985. And in 1992, Patty Limerick contributed essays to the book Revealing Territory, Photographs of the Southwest by Mark Klett. There are also books edited and books forthcoming. She indeed is based in Boulder, Colorado, where she is a professor of history at the University of Colorado, Boulder, and has been since 1984. Prior to that, she was at Yale and at Harvard. This is Conversations. You said wrote at some point in Legacy of Conquest that if John Wayne was the figure of the true West, he would not have been characterized as a sheriff or a gunslinger, but rather as a surveyor or a lawyer or a land speculator. Why?
Well, that's the basic drama. The basic drama is taking land and drawing lines on maps and dividing up land and turning it into property, to individually owned property. And that's what the whole thing that we call whatever the frontier, westward expansion, that's what it is in lived reality, is deciding how to chop things up and how to assign ownership to it. And that is, of course, something where one person will win and another person will lose in many episodes. So it was contested and full of friction and full of heat and full of human passion. I think one of the worst things that we did to history, and I apologize for my people on doing this, was that we, in the last 20 or 30 years, history became such a social science that everything became a product of big forces and big themes. And so economic behavior was just the dullest thing on the planet. It was such a flat, rational, humans just seek profit, and that's a law of the universe. Well, is Western expansion is the best case study for telling us that this is a matter of strong emotion. This is not just rational economic creatures seeking their their best interest. This is all of the strongest emotions. So by saying that John Wayne could have been or should have been a lawyer, I'm not saying that the movie should have been dull and they should have been filmed with that you could somehow or other John Ford should have found a way to make a title search into a fascinating human draw. I'm talking about is just as much human passion as you see in the movies, but based on that question of who owns what and who will profit from those transactions and deciding who owns what. So the lawyer is the land lawyer and the water lawyer, especially the key figures in much of Western history. And yet we have spent our time as Western historians writing books upon books about miners and cowboys and so on, hundreds of books on cowboys. And to my knowledge, hardly a book on Western lawyers. I mean, biographies of a few individuals, one book on lawyers in Kansas. But it's just a completely underwritten topic of how crucial and central the lawyers are in that and how much this is just a business of people setting up a legal system that rewards those who've won in the struggle for property.
I don't want to be terribly emotionally symbolic about all this, but was this great motive of getting property a matter of staking one's claim and thus one's legitimacy on the face of the earth? I am what I stand on?
Well, I mean, I think that's a very strong part of it, especially for European immigrants. The notion of owning land is so much what they could not have in Europe, and what was the promise of the United States was the chance that you could be a full self-reliant citizen by being your own property owner. So I don't want to take anything away from that, but it does seem like a lot of homesteaders were interested in getting the claim, watching land values rise, selling out at a higher profit, and then trying it again. So we usually use the word speculator to mean the big guys, the ones who clearly were not interested in working the soil themselves in the virtuous Jeffersonian manner. But I think in the basic phases of Western expansion that everybody's a speculator. I mean, what kind of weirdness would possess somebody to be the one person in a newly settled area not wanting land values to rise, not wanting to have the prospect of selling out at a profit? So it's a complicated business that there are some really powerful socio-psychological impulses for landowning, but there's also a sense that land is the hottest commodity around, and if you can get there early and make a claim and then sell out and then get someplace else early, that's as sensible a, it seems as sensible a thing as, more sensible than staying there in virtuous relationship to your soil.
So there are a couple of things going on here, and one is you mentioned Thomas Jefferson's view that the agrarian life was the highest form of life and would create a peaceful, interactive nation. That's one theme that perhaps even land speculators had in mind.
I suppose land speculators had their own vision of themselves as the innocent servants of a great cause. I mean, that's available to them if they want that sense that they step in and handle the process of land development and land distribution. So I suppose there is that, but there's also just a strange an abstract sense of land, not as anybody's home necessarily, but as the commodity that will find its best market. And if that turns out to build a stable society, well, that would be fine, but that's not the goal. The goal is something else entirely. So many Western communities have such a precarious economic base and a precarious social base from that legacy that it doesn't really matter what the land is and what you are to that land in a permanent relationship. It's what you can take out of it. Sort of the Christmas wrappings view of nature, that if there's something valuable wrapped up in nature, then you rip it apart the way children rip up things at Christmas and then take out the valuable thing, which might be a mineral or might be a water that you divert into another territory. And when you've got that out, then who wants the wrappings? Who wants that?
You rushed by a thought, but it sounds like we should go back to it. That is what makes economies of many Western communities unstable today.
Yeah, the Christmas wrappings model of the human relationship to nature is not built for the long haul. It's short-term business, whether you're talking about mining or oil drilling or coal mining or logging or certain kinds of farming, which border right up on extractive farming. That's something where you might do very well in the short run, and the short run might be quite long. The short run might be a half a century or more, but the party is going to end. The party is not going to be able to go on, not because you're going to reach a sad moment where there's nothing left, where the children at Christmas say, "Is that all? We run out of presents." You won't reach that moment, but you'll reach a moment where it is more expensive than it is rewarding to mine the thing, where it's just more trouble to pump water from the aquifer than it is more expense and trouble. It costs more in energy pumping costs than you receive in the reward of the water you get from it. So it's not that you hit a moment of depletion, but you hit a moment where it just doesn't make economic sense to do that. And then what happens to those towns? Well, it's what you can see happening all over the west of the farm and ranch communities that are shrinking in population, the mining towns that have a whole slew of them over the last century and a half that have prospered and been places where 10,000, 15,000 people all lived and bustled around, and then within sometimes a few days that can just end. The company decides, the main mining company decides that it's no longer economically productive, mine closes, jobs are gone, ripple effect is instant, that the storekeepers and the professionals who serve the mining population have no basis, and everybody's out of there sometimes within the space of months. There's nothing more irritating on the planet than smug hindsight. I mean, so I think there's something that we just have to watch in ourselves where we start sounding like Howard Cosell or one of those sort of, well, they didn't play that very well, did they? I mean, that's just an insufferable thing to do, and especially it's insufferable when so many people in the West today are in such painful situations, that poor souls in the timber towns of the Pacific Northwest who are facing a reckoning there, which is not a pleasant or happy one, and not one that they're going to get out of without more pain than they're feeling right now. So smug hindsight, don't want to do that. But it doesn't take long after you step back to think that was not the form, that was not the basis for a permanent society. That was the basis for a raid.
But in this case, the past is like a locomotive rather than being something that stopped in any given year, 1890 or anything else. It's carrying everything with it into the future. Mm-hmm. So it's not something we can stop and say, well, we did that very poorly. Let's start again.
Right. I mean, I think that's the scariest part about the whole notion of set patterns. I mean, there's no question that there are these set patterns, and that the rise of conservation at the turn of the last century added up to something, but it was still the basic mentality of use the resources and something will work out for us over the long run. That's been running now for a century and a half, and it's very distressing and alarming to think that we're just stuck, that we just have to ride this train over the cliff. I mean, those are the scariest movies that you can barely stand to watch, where the engineer has been hit and lost consciousness, and the bridge is down up ahead of the train, and the train is just heading right into the plunge there. But I just think there's so much of human history that is improbable and unpredictable that to get that sense of inevitability is not workable. I mean, one of the best examples of that is if you look at 19th century white settlers in the West who are determined to get rid of predators. The first thing to do to improve a place, or one of the first things to do, is to get rid of those damned wolves, because the wolves eat the livestock, and the livestock are crucial to the early settler economy. So exterminating wolves is the priority for many Western settlements. Well, if you could do time travel, and if you could go back to the 1830s or 1840s, you could go to Oregon, where they were all determined to get rid of these nasty pests. And if you wanted to surprise them with how much things had changed over the next century and a half, I mean, you could do nuclear power, or you could do airplanes or something. I mean, that's the cheap way of surprising them. The one that I think would be much more astonishing if they really took in the meaning of it is that after 150 years, or actually less than that, we would arrive at a situation where wolves had attorneys, where when wolves had a problem, they had the best attorneys. They had attorneys who appeared in court and represented wolves. I mean, I can't imagine a settler from the 1830s or 1840s thinking anything, but let's work on the airplanes make more sense. I mean, I can understand the airplane in a way that this other thing just can't. That just is so batty. And owls, I mean, an owl sued in its own name. An owl went to court. It's Spotted Owl. That's the name of the suit. It's Spotted Owl versus, I guess, the Secretary of Agriculture. So what an astonishing thing. And if you just contemplate that fact, I think that can start to jolt you out of the, oh, we were just riding this train over the cliff and we're buckled into our seats and we can't do anything about it. I mean, humans do have will. Humans have will, and they use that will in just improbable and astonishing ways.
Bad news, good news.
Hmm?
This is Patty Limerick on Conversations. Just a note of Patty's intellectual past. She was educated at the University of California, Santa Cruz, as she mentioned, where she earned a bachelor's in American Studies. That was in 1972. She went on to Yale for a PhD program, also in American Studies, and graduated from that institution with her PhD in 1980. She worked at Yale while a student from 1974 to 1980, teaching while at school, went on to Harvard as an assistant professor from 80 to 1984, and then to University of Colorado Boulder. Patty Limerick on Conversations today. I'd like to take some time to look at kind of the diverse populations of the American West. When we think of the American West, we tend to be fairly xenophobic about the whole thing. We see a fairly large, strapping white fellow who tends to look either like Gary Cooper or John Wayne. Let's debunk this by looking first at the American woman on the frontier. Who was she? What did she look like? And what did she accomplish?
I mean, the first and most important thing in some ways to do is to say sometimes she was an Indian, sometimes she was a Hispanic, sometimes she was an Asian immigrant. So she is that image of the sunbonneted white helpmate to her noble husband is so strong in our heads that it held the first Western women's historians captive. I mean, they'd write books called things like Women and Indians. Now, you think about that one, you think, were the Indians all unisex? I mean, were the only women who counted white? And that's the clear premise of that title. But I think that's just, I don't think that was intentional malevolence or anything like that on the part of the author. It was just so much the assumption that Western woman meant white pioneer woman. So the best action in many ways has been taking Indian women seriously from the beginning, that fur traders don't know how to make a lot of the things they need to make. They don't snowshoes, or that's not an easy thing for a fur trader to do in the 1810s or 1820s. And so marriage with an Indian woman had very practical, down-to-earth things. Also sometimes great personal affection and trade values, that it gave you as the trader, it gave you a tie to a tribe. So what seemed to be the archetypal white male in the wilderness story of fur trappers and fur traders in the mountain man era, look at them, and it turns out that there's a very important gender business there, that the Indian women are very crucial to that story. So, and the same thing with New Mexico, that intermarriage between Anglo and Irish traders on the Santa Fe Trail with New Mexican Hispanic women served exactly the same sort of purpose of emotional needs, but also a commercial trade tie to New Mexican society. Same for California and the Mexican and Spanish people in California. So it turns out that there's it never works to just see the tough white man as the center of the story. That's you just have to distort the camera angle very badly to get the woman who was an essential part of that story, and sometimes a woman of another ethnic background. As to white pioneer women, I think we're still struggling with that one. That we have a model, which is quite well said, of the weak and frail woman who doesn't want to go, who gets bullied into going by her husband, and who just sits and weeps and yearns for home in a frail sort of way. Well, the Donner Party, for instance, when the Donner Party got stuck in the Sierras in 1846 and through the winter of 1847, more women survived the Donner Party than men. Now, that's an extraordinary thing, because human suffering doesn't go much further than that, getting stuck in the Sierras in the snow. So if you had nothing else besides the survival rate of the Donner Party women, you'd have to think, frail, delicate, not up to men in stamina, and that to struggle through the snow as these women did is just a powerful statement. We owe them that. We owe them that sense that treating them like the poor, delicate captives to men's will is not doing them justice. So, but what seems to be the pattern is that in their own heads, in these 19th century women's head, was a notion of what appropriate female behavior was. So even though, for instance, it seems that a number of them drove the wagon on the Overland Trail, they always tried to present it as an exceptional situation. Women were not supposed to drive wagons, and so they did it because Bill was sick or because he was preoccupied with driving the livestock, or some excuse gets offered. I mean, and what's so fascinating is that you can come right down to the present and see when Teresa Jordan wrote a book about cowgirls, about ranch women in the 1970s, 1980s, they almost to a person kept saying, "Now, you know, I am not a feminist. I am not a feminist. I think the man is in charge. But yeah, I can brand, I can rope, I can do all those things. I do all those things when he's away. I can manage the ranch. I am not a feminist. You understand? I'm not that." So it's, I think the 19th century has that same pattern of women doing all of these remarkable and demanding and exhausting forms of labor, often outdoors, but still, when they had the chance, trying to retreat back to what seemed to be society's definition of what proper behavior.
What about the notion of the gentler, now this is a different mm-hmm. different way of looking at it than frail, but morally upright, the taming of the tamer yeah. of the rampant spirit of the male.
Well, that's where I think we do, again, a great disservice to people of the past when we make them seem nicer than they were. There were plenty of instances where white women showed themselves to be just as hostile to Indian people, including Indian women, as white men. In fact, it's not uncommon for white women in the fur trade to be very, when the Hudson's Bay Company, for instance, finally allowed white traders to bring in white wives, the tension between the white wives and the Indian women was quite a terrible, terrible thing, because for the 19th century, your marriage is your property as a white woman, and someone who threatens that is your worst competitor, and that might be an Indian woman, or in certain Western settings, it might be prostitutes. I mean, there's some just very unhappy and unpleasant experiences there of struggling prostitutes being treated cruelly and horribly by white middle-class women who were fighting for their own little stake on that. Now, that doesn't seem to me to take anything away from them, to show that they were not saintly in a consistent way. I mean, their circumstances did not permit them to be saintly. Human beings are very seldom saintly. So that notion of women as morally superior, and I'm not really sure how much of a service we do them if we buy that. Elliot West has an absolutely wonderful book on childhood in the West, and obviously the raising of children under circumstances like that does come right up on heroism. I mean, the horror of children traveling with children on the trail who fell off of wagons, fell near wheels, sometimes fell under wheels. I mean, just the sense of precariousness all around you and trying to perform your duties and keep your eye on those children under those circumstances is almost beyond imagining. I mean, any story that you read about the problems of daycare in our society, you think, oh, to have such problems, oh, what a treat to not have these others. So I wouldn't take a thing away from the real struggle of women coping with those kinds of challenges, women in situations where there is no well for the first few years of a farm, so every time you need water, you carry the water. All those things are really impressive and soul-stirring kinds of things when you contemplate them, but that doesn't mean that they were a model for us in tolerance and civilized behavior necessarily. That just that very sense of precariousness could make them all the more hostile to others. On that, I quoted in Legacy, I quoted a perfectly horrible woman who was one of the leaders in the anti-Asian campaign in California, and if you just read her language, your assumption is it's a male speaker. We have to throw all the Chinese out of California, just like the Bostonians threw the tea into Boston Harbor. We're going to throw the Chinese into the sea. Oh, lady, don't you? I mean, at those moments, you want to reach back to the past and say, now madam, there is this stereotype of women as morally superior, and it would just be nice if you cooperated with that. Huh? But I think it's important to look at those women and to say that this is the full range of human character, and it's just not a service to the past to try to pretty it up.
When we think of race issues in the past of the American West, we will almost inevitably think of settlers, people crossing towards the West from the East, and their racial stresses with the Indian population. There is greater complex issues to racialism in the American West, yes, including Chinese in California.
Yeah, in fact, I think that's one of the most compelling reasons for everybody to pay attention to the American West, wherever they live in this nation, or I suppose on this planet, is that if you don't look at the American West, you can do what a lot of college-level American history textbook writers have done, because I've seen these things where they say in the 1960s or 1970s, race relations ceased to be focused on black-white relations. Well, it was never focused on black-white relations, but you have a model of American history which is so preoccupied with relations between the North and the South, between whites and blacks, slaves and their owners, that you miss what is a tremendously complicated story in the West, which is closer to the way it ended up, closer to the way that the nation ended up. So you have Indian people of all possible cultural backgrounds, much wider range of ways of life and worldviews and political systems in the West than in the eastern United States. Then prior colonization and settlement by Spanish-speaking people in the Southwest, or what we now call the Southwest, while they were still, I mean, Oñate was setting up a permanent colony in New Mexico in 1598, and that's 9 years before they were floundering around at Jamestown in Virginia. So a much longer prior colonization by the Spanish before Anglo-Americans come into the story. And then, of course, an upsurge in Mexican immigration in our own time. So there's the long-term Spanish-Mexican origin people, and then there's much more recent arrivals. Then the whole flood of people coming from the other direction entirely, the people making the move in the reverse. Instead of east to west, it's west to east of Asia to the Pacific coast. And that, I actually just wrote a post, an article last year on the discovery of the landscape from the other direction. Our notion of discovery is so much on the people move from the eastern United States to the west and are surprised by the Great Plains and then really spooked by the desert and so on. Reversing that just turned out to be such a fascinating way of, and it's one of those things where at first traditional historians tell you, well, you can't do that. You can't do the Asian American discovery of the landscape because there aren't any sources. You have to go with Lewis and Clark because Lewis and Clark kept records. Well, it turns out there's an abundant set of sources because Chinese and Japanese people have a tradition and had a tradition where regular people could compose verses, where we think we have special licensed people. I'm not sure if we give them licenses, but I think they're supposed to have licenses. Poets, they're poets, and they're called poets, and they get to write poetry. Well, in Chinese and Japanese societies, there's a tradition where regular folk compose them in their heads while they're working out in the sun, working out in the field. So it turns out there's a rich source of, that's just one category of verses that convey people's responses to the landscape from the other direction. Well, anyway, if you add all of those people in, and African-American people in the story as well, from the first black person who traveled with Lewis and Clark, or the fellow who traveled with the Spanish through Texas in 1528, Estevanico. So everybody's in there. Everybody's in there. And you couldn't, unless willfully distorting the past, you couldn't say just black-white relations. You have to see American race relations as having six or seven groups meet from different directions. So I think if you study Western history, you get grounded in a model of American race relations, which leaves you better able to cope with present times, instead of this thing that you hear from a lot of traditional American historians. Well, it was one thing to have to try to deal with the blacks and their issues. Now we have all these Chicanos and we have all these people who demand our attention. Well, Chicanos have been there for 400 years, and it deserves some attention. That's not a rational demand on the part of some prickly Hispanic people of our times. That's a perfectly appropriate request that history be realistic.
What about this issue that doesn't just come from historians? I mean, in literature, it comes from English professors and writers of criticism. And they're talking about the canon of literature. They say if you let all these diverse influences in, all these other book writers and poets and novelists and essayists, there's no base any longer for understanding, quote, our, end quote, literature. This same argument comes up, whether from historians or politicians. Right. If we let all these people in, my God, it's nothing but chaos.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I don't know what it does to fight reality in a reality that's several centuries old. For the state of Colorado, or even goofier, the state of California, to have an English-only law is I guess it would be laughable if it weren't also wounding and injurious. I mean, that they were speaking Spanish long before they were speaking English in what's now the state of California. And so it doesn't make any sense to fight a diversity that has been there before you and your people arrive there. I don't see what the politicians and everybody else sees of these groups resolutely refusing to assimilate. I don't see that. It seems to me what you see much more is long, long waiting lists for English classes in Los Angeles of immigrants just really quite desperate to get what they need in the way of a language tool to. And I don't see what's wrong with being bilingual. Is this an injury? I mean, it's the most embarrassing thing in the world that whenever our presidents go to meetings with international leaders, the other international leaders are all chattering away in some common language, and it's our president who has to have the interpreter, who has to have them. What did they say? What did they say? Sort of mode. So if we have language diversity, is this something to weep over? I think not. Plus, if anybody who just calms down and looks at the situation that people are, American historians or literature professors who are moaning over the canon, I think if you go to the bedrock of what they're saying what is legitimate, they have too much to read. It was hard enough trying to keep up with American writers when you just did white men. Now there are these superb Asian American writers. Faye Ng's new book, Bone, is just such an astonishing book and as beautifully crafted as anything anybody's come up with. But I can understand why some poor English professor who has really should go back and reread Hawthorne, because if you reread Hawthorne, it's richer and better than it was the first two times you read it, but who's sitting there meanwhile in his office grading all the papers, and then he has to go to a committee meeting, and then you say, you're not paying any attention to Asian American writers. No wonder the poor thing says, I can't. I mean, well, the problem is they don't say I can't. They don't say I can't keep up with this stuff. I have other lives I wanted to lead. When I go home at night, I'd like to be able to say hello to my family. Now, I think it really is a case of too much stuff of quality, but nobody wants to stand up in public. No professor wants to say, I can't keep up with my reading, because that's what the students are saying to you all the time in your official approach has to be then read more,
right.
Find more time on that. But I think that's part of the grumpiness, really, is that. It's that it's just very tough for one person to take in all the really wonderful and fine writing. But I just wish we could get it out of the framework of saying it's these pushy Chicano writers and Asian American writers who are ruining our lives. They're enriching our lives. They're not ruining our lives. But I do understand the problem of how to find time to read it. That's why I'm glad that I travel, because on airplanes I can read these novels. So.
If we generalize this frustration on the part of history professors or on the part of English professors to the nation defining itself, is there kind of a crisis of identity as we move to the future, all of us together?
Well, I think there'd better be a crisis of identity, because a version of American history that was so centered on events on the Atlantic coast in the 1770s is not going to work. It's not going to hold us together. The writers of the Constitution is extremely important and does in some way glue us together. But in the meantime, there were people in New Mexico and Texas and California who were not taking part in the Constitutional Convention, and their descendants are part of the nation now, and they have as much right to be included in the big story of the nation, not right in a political sense, but in a factual sense, that if you are going to tell the story of this nation, the settlements in New Mexico count as much as the settlements in Massachusetts, or certainly the settlements in California. As California became the most populous state, I mean, that's a big deal. And at that point, you really do have to rethink how you're telling the story, as whites may be on their way to being a minority population, as the other minority, so-called minority populations grow. We'd better have an identity crisis, and we'd better come out of it with a sense that a story so centered on the doings of white people is not in white people's interest. It's not in anybody's interest to have that kind of exclusive thing. And it's not just even a matter of race. It's a matter of class, that to leave working class people out of this, white ones as well as people of color, that's no good either.
Patty Limerick, our guest today on Conversations, was born in Banning, California in 1951, a lifelong student and professor and now writer. Among books in progress, you'll see at some point soon Something in the Soil, a collection of essays currently on contract for W.W. Norton, and The Atomic West, also for Norton. The Atomic West is predictably about things atomic in the West?
Well, it seemed to me when I was working on Legacy that one of the best ways to argue for the significance of this region and to set it free of the old cowboys and Indians and pioneers model was to say what is true, that the American West has been at the forefront and center of nuclear activities and certainly now is at the center of the consequences of nuclear activities, and that that's true on every count that you can imagine of whether it was the research center at Los Alamos or the plutonium production center at the Hanford Reservation in Washington or the test site, the first test in Alamogordo, or the creation of the Nevada test site in 1951, or the weapons assembly plants at Rocky Flats and Amarillo at Pantex. All those things, the uranium rushes, the Four Corners uranium rush, the Black Hills uranium mining scene, all of those things are Western and not by accident, because the aridity and altitude of lots of Western spaces made them sparsely inhabited. So when the federal government in World War II and the Cold War looked for places that seemed to be good for bombing or good for the production of bombs, then the West was the obvious winner on that, because they actually did consider the coast of North Carolina for what became the Nevada test site, which makes more sense because the winds would blow carrying the radiation out to the Atlantic. But North Carolina seems populated in people's minds in a way that Nevada does not. Nevada was the area, the test site, they said, virtually uninhabited, which was not a phrase welcomed by what they later called the virtual uninhabitants of Nevada, who were very much affected by that development. So, and then, of course, when it comes to the question of the consequences of nuclear development, it's the West that wins all the time when they look for a place for permanent nuclear waste disposal. Officially, the mandate of Congress was to consider the entire United States, but surprise, surprise, when they narrowed down the candidates, it was all Western sites. So nuclear waste disposal and all the questions of cleanup now are very much centered on the West. So I wanted to do a book that really put the whole package together of the, and I've left out several things. I mean, missile siting and the command post for launching missions, all sorts of ways in which we won the prize for
some prize.
Yeah.
When can we expect it?
Oh, that's a terrible question.
Oh,
I enjoyed the interview up until this point. Now we've taken a bad turn. I don't know, probably 4 years.
Okay. The Atomic West, promised to W.W. Norton and the American readers. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. We have a few minutes left, and I have a couple of questions out of odd angles. So here's one. Why do kids still play cowboys and Indians and would never consider playing masters and slaves? What's that in our belief about ourselves?
Well, that's the whole dilemma of Western history in a nutshell, that everybody caught on during the Civil Rights Movement that Southern history was serious and consequential, and it was not a children's game to play masters and slaves. Somehow we have not had a comparable moment of nationwide recognition that the conquest of the American West was serious and had serious consequences. I mean, we have a very set piece of white liberals feeling bad about what we did to the Indians. But that's such a superficial, I mean, the Kevin Costner, oh, boo-hoo, the poor Sioux, and that doesn't add up to a serious reckoning with the issue. I mean, it just becomes another, oh, these noble people, how sad that we miss them. The people we have today are not like those noble people of the 19th century, people with drinking problems on reservations. Those are not the noble Sioux of the 19th century, you know. So I don't think that romanticizing of the noble victims of conquest added up to much in the way of a serious rethinking of who we are to the living survivors of those conquered people. So somehow we've never had the moment where parents would develop a consciousness that would make them uncomfortable when one child picks up a gun and says, "You're the Indian," bang, bang, on that. Where if a child picked up a whip and said, "You're the slave," I think most parents would think, oh, Lordy, what have we got going here? How do we get this under control? But somehow the other, I guess by the huge legacy, I mean, there is Gone with the Wind. There is a tradition of Southern misty, soft-focus lens kind of romanticizing of plantations. But it's paltry, I guess, compared to what we've had in romanticizing of the Western past and trivializing of the Western past through the movies.
And we somehow see Selma in more human, more personal mm-hmm. terms than we see Wounded Knee.
Right, right. Or any of the Indian reservation border towns with where the liquor cellars pile up so that people will have to drive off reservation there and run terrible risks of getting killed in drunk driving accidents on the way back. I mean, that's in some ways an ongoing Selma, or it should be that. But it's just tough to get people's attention to that, I guess, because it's remote, because it's I don't know. It's a great puzzle to me why I was driven mad once in a dinner party conversation in Boulder where this man was leaving to go teach at the University of North Carolina, and he was telling me that he was very interested in African-American literature and African-American history. I said, you've been living in Colorado. I mean, isn't Indian history or Chicano history, isn't that? He said, that's not as interesting. You know, I just have to be frank with you. I just have to tell you, it's just not as interesting. I thought, put me in another seat at this table because I cannot be responsible for myself on that. Not to take a thing away from the significance of African-American history, but it's just a weird business that somehow or other that has a seriousness in the American public's mind that the other minority, Western minority issues just don't seem as compelling.
Last question. You argue towards the end of The Legacy of Conquest that a moral complexity, an historical view which embraces a moral complexity, does not lessen or mm-hmm. confuse our history, mm-hmm. but makes the parables and the lessons greater. Mm-hmm. And you liken it to the Greek view of mm-hmm. their own times. Can you give us a few thoughts on that as we conclude?
Well, that if you want to stir human souls, which everybody ought to want to do, if you want to tell stories that have serious and deep meaning, then those stories had better have a tragic component or reckon with the tragic elements of human nature. If the kind of Sunday school parables about good little boys and good little girls make you want to go out and pull the wings off flies. The parables of people who were just saintly and sweet throughout their lives, who wants it? There's no inspiration in that, but the parables of tragically flawed people who struggle with that. I mean, if there's anything more moving on the planet than stories of overland travelers sharing water on the trail when they're in the midst of the terrible desert crossing and they don't know if they're going to make it to the water. I mean, some historians have said another 5 miles of desert and the mortality rate would have been huge on that. So people under the most agonizing situations who share water, sometimes with strangers. I mean, who could ask for anything more inspirational? And that's the kind of inspirational behavior that would not have... You need a tragic context for that to make sense. If people share water when they have plenty of water, who cares? That's the... a dull thing. Or if people share water because they have intrinsic noble pioneer characteristics that mean that they have to share water. But when you see people really struggle, really tormented by those tests of loyalty, that's where things get meaningful. So to see tragedy is just to see the full depth and power of Western American history. It's not to take anything away from it, but to add the kind of depth that can make it a lesson for us in our times. I mean, the question of sharing resources, that's the issue of our time. And to suggest that there might be some happy resolution where everyone can get everything they want and mm-hmm. everything will work out, that is no help for us in our time. So tragedy makes the world go round. And
we've been talking on Conversations with historian Patricia Nelson Limerick. A book you might look up, The Legacy of Conquest, The Unbroken Past of the American West. It was published by W.W. Norton in 1987, and there's a good deal more to come from historian Patricia Limerick. I'm Susan McGinnis. Thanks a lot, Patty.
Thank you.
You can find this and earlier episodes of Conversations on the KUAC website. I'm Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.